is University Forum. I'm Gene Moore, bringing you conversations with outstanding personalities on issues of interest to local, national, and international communities. Our topic today, Forged in Blood, Black Wealth Injustice in the United States. My guest, Dr. Rose Brewer, Associate Professor and Morse Alumni Distinguished Teaching Professor of African American and African Studies at the University of Minnesota. Among her extensive writing and editorial activities, she also is on the editorial board of the National Journal of Sociology. Welcome to University Forum, Dr. Brewer.
Thank you for inviting me.
My pleasure. Forged in Blood, Black Wealth Injustice in the United States is chapter 3 of a book, The Color of Wealth, the story behind the United States racial wealth divide. And it includes other chapters, including Native Americans, Latinos, Asians, as well as whites. How did the book develop, and what was your own involvement in that process?
Well, you need to understand the organization United for a Fair Economy, which is a community-based organization located in Boston, Massachusetts, does work on economic inequality in this country. One of the earlier books, the book titled Economic Apartheid, gets into some of these issues. So it's an ongoing part of the work of the organization to look at how wealth is either concentrated or distributed in this country. I was a board member at the time that we began talking about possibly developing a book. The organization does workshops on the racial wealth divide, and so that was a part of an earlier history, and also released a couple of years ago the State of the Dream report, which looked at the status of African Americans in the wake of Dr. King's birthday celebration, and released a report at that time, which can also be found at the United for a Fair Economy website. So a group of activists as well as academics, and those of us who call ourselves both activists and academics, involved with United for a Fair Economy and some not involved, decided to try to pull this together. It was a complicated story. We wanted to go beyond the workshop material and really do an extensive analysis. One of the other concerns was to move beyond the black-white analysis, even though that's a very powerful and central point to the story, and to bring in other groups of color, such as the American Indian, Native American population, the Latinos, the Asian population, and the chapter also includes an analysis of white wealth in this society.
I notice it's written by 5 women. Is that correct?
That is correct.
Is that just coincidental?
Not 100% coincidental. There have been men who have played a role, give out a number of acknowledgments, and the book has taken a while to finally come to fruition. But in terms of the people who were left standing, we were the women who were left standing.
That has happened.
Yeah.
But let's talk about your section, which is a very powerful section. I've looked at the other parts of it, but I really want to concentrate with you on the one that you wrote. And it's called Forged in Blood, Black Wealth Injustice in the United States. And that's indeed a strong title. And you begin with specific statistical data, you know, illustrating the extent of the wealth divide. How divided is the wealth at this point?
The wealth, unfortunately, has become even more divided. It's the wealth concentration in this country. I wish I could say it's decreasing, but it has increased. And for African Americans, we've lost some ground. I am of African American descent, if your listeners are interested. And the past 4 years, in fact, as you might know, have seen the expansion of poverty, again, heavily hitting the black population, the African-American population. And one of the most appalling statistics in my section is the number of African-American men of working age who no longer are part of the labor market. At the time that I was gathering those statistics, in the city of Chicago, it was something like only half of the African-American working-age men were in the labor force. So rather than gaining ground, there was a bit of a blip, a momentary blip, but some actual devolution in terms of the status of African Americans. I think right now we average about wealth-wise 17 cents for every dollar that whites have in this country.
Now, do a throwback and move us somewhat historically, because this is very important and very well done, as I see you, where you've pulled this into this particular section of the book, and the theft of African labor. Start with that.
Indeed. I wanted intentionally for the title to be powerful and forceful, because the expropriation of black labor, which built this country, which is the basis of the takeoff capital for the most powerful economic country in the world today, was in fact African labor. And the cost for that labor for African descent people was very, very high and continues to be very, very high. And often it was through the blood of our ancestors, through violence, through, of course, forced immigration to this country, that this was possible. And what I've tried to do, as do the other authors, is take us through this history, because I don't think we can understand how we've gotten to the present moment without being aware of that deeper history. And I know we're a country and a people often who don't have that much interest in historical facts, but it is quite true that especially for wealth, wealth is something over the longer haul that's passed on generationally. So you can't understand how a population or a group ends up without wealth until you understand that one generation passes on those resources to the next. And if you're cut off at the legs in the earlier generation, it's going to make it very, very difficult unless there is some dramatic intervention. And so we wanted to emphasize that, and I certainly wanted to make that point, but also make the point that specific government policies from the very inception of this country, for example, in 1790, it was very, very explicit that in order to be naturalized or a citizen of this country, you had to be white.
Yes.
We know the story of the three-fifths so-called compromise, which made African-American people part property, part human, if that's in any way possible, but a specific political decision made by the white male elite in the society that reduced some of the political power of the South, because the South was the site of Southern slave ownership, and increased to some extent the power of the North. Two other parts of that so-called compromise was the supposed ending of slavery by 1808, and the fact that over historical time, the institution was to be phased out. None of that, of course, unfolded in the way that it was proposed, and slavery went on very deep into the 19th century. I didn't talk very much about Juneteenth, but in fact, after the Emancipation Proclamation, it took over 2 years for the enslaved in Texas to be freed. So we're talking about an institution that goes deep almost into, the 20th century. And if you include the 100 years of legal segregation or racial apartheid, tenant farming and sharecropping, which were systems of labor that were basically almost slavery except in name, and then you have a very extensive 400-plus year history of the divestment of wealth out of African-American hands.
Yes, and if you stay a bit with the earlier part of that history, the various laws that involved also the struggle for land,
right.
I think you hit a very important aspect, and how this affected the wealth, because land.
Yeah.
Talk about that.
I sure will. I'll mention a couple of decisions that were dramatic and important. For example, there was an important moment at the ending of the Civil War when we might perhaps would not be having this conversation, when, for example, the special order done by General Sherman, Special Field Order Number 15, which allocated thousands of acres from Charleston, from the Sea Islands, so-called abandoned rice lands, to the African-American population into Florida and supposedly set aside for the newly freed. That land was, I won't say given, it was fought for, but then the order was rescinded. And so no additional distribution of land was made possible. And that's what the newly freed African Americans wanted. They wanted land to begin cultivating their own farms, to provide for their families. So a dramatic moment of possible land redistribution was, shall we say, stopped in its birth. And then the Freedmen's Bureau had land redistribution set of policies, and about 40,000 families, at least initially, got some of that land, old Confederate land. But that land also was ultimately taken back. Many of those families pushed off. These were governmental policies that could have made a difference in Black lives and the decision-making of both, I would say, the Union and the Confederacy, what was the old Confederacy, in alliance with one another, basically stop these redistribution policies.
And then there's the land that people did own, Black people owned, that was, you get into the bloody summer.
Right.
And what happened then. And you're a product of people from Tulsa.
I am, and I talk about my story. Tulsa is an interesting case, just as Rosewood, Florida, is a case that people might know about. And that period in 1919, when the violence and the reaction in the wake of oftentimes white veterans returning from World War One, and the competition for jobs and resources was very, very intense. In my own home city of Tulsa, there had emerged over a few decades a relatively prosperous area known as the Greenwood area. There were businesses, there were resources that people had acquired. I was even told that there were individuals who owned private planes, so there was some prosperity in that community. It was also a site of a very large Klan population, and Oklahoma as a state had, in fact, instituted in its laws many of the laws of the Old South. In fact, as that no man's land was being settled, many of the old Southerners left the South in the post-Civil War period and came to Oklahoma, bringing with them the assumptions around racial segregation. And so they became codified into the state constitution. And so Tulsa was Jim Crowed. It was very much a racially segregated city with blacks living on the north side and whites on the south. But even in the wake of that, a very motivated and prosperous black community did emerge. Not every African American in Tulsa was prosperous, but significant enough that it caught the attention of the white population, engendering what it did nationwide: jealousy, hatred, and I think really spurred on by the white press in Tulsa. This is a bigger story than I get into.
I know the story, yes. And I know that it's going to, in terms of, take us to the, as we get to the middle part of our show, what happened there, we know. But talk a little bit about what happened to the people as a whole there.
Certainly. The wealth that had been acquired in businesses, in housing, that was destroyed. People lost their homes. And one of the most dramatic aspects of that conflagration was that the black community was actually removed in the wake of the fires, in the wake of the destruction, and herded out of the city. Again, I don't get into all of those details. So I call it ethnic cleansing in a way that is really, when you think about it in the whole scale of things, the destruction of the property, destruction of the land, the billions of dollars that, if that those resources had been passed on generationally, would have been available to this generation of Tulsans, black Tulsans. And the removal of the black population is a story that needs wide telling. So the loss of land, the loss of wealth is a big piece of this.
Yes, and I think the fact that Tulsa was not alone, that there were many other parts where the white community rioted against the black community.
Absolutely.
In this, including places like Elaine, Arkansas, and some others. And you're listening to University Forum with my guest, Dr. Rose Brewer, Associate Professor of Sociology at the University of Minnesota and author of Forged in Blood, Black Wealth Injustice in the United States. Many of these things that happened through that era did not have any supportive help from the government. But in fact, as we think beyond that, you mentioned in your book the role of the government in the racial divide, partly what you mentioned earlier in the show. And what were some of the other things that began to emerge where the government took or failed to take certain kinds of actions?
Right. I think two important pieces we need to discuss in the wake of the GIs returning from the Second World War and housing policy more generally. Let's begin with housing policy more generally, which has its roots in some of the policies that emerged in the New Deal. The New Deal, of course, under Franklin Delano Roosevelt, occurred because this country was in a depression, and the black community, the African-American community across this country was very, very hard hit. But the U.S. government began to put into place a number of bills, acts, policies that began to pull the white population out of this malaise, but worked much less well for the African-American population. And I'm thinking of two instances, the case of Social Security, which Social Security insurance provided support in old age, but also unemployment insurance and disability support ultimately. And in fact, the two major occupations that African-Americans were heavily represented, farming, agricultural work, and domestic work during that period, were excluded. And Southern legislators, lawmakers, who generally fought New Deal legislation, fought tooth and nail to exclude these occupations because it meant that they had a very desperate, it would mean a very desperate group of workers who were not covered by federal legislation and who had the, who were not in a position to argue with the wage and benefit exploitation of those two fields. And the government conceded that those areas of work would not be included, and it disproportionately affected the African-American population. In fact, up until around the mid-60s, domestic work was known as black women's labor. And can you imagine if that would have been provided fairly? Unemployment, insurance, old age support, the community in general would have been much better off.
Your point was so clearly put and so seldom looked at, especially with domestic workers. The work that they were doing was completely devalued and yet used, and they were exploited.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And it's amazing when you think about it because it was just left on the side and nobody wanted to bring it to the fore. And I was so pleased when I saw you emphasize that in this section of the book.
Okay.
The black farmers, too, the lawsuits.
The black farmers. Essentially, this was a continuation of the older strategy of exploiting tenant farmers and sharecroppers, because even by the 1930s, this was disproportionately a black population, very vulnerable, had been used and abused and continued to be used and abused in the South of the 1930s, producing products and goods for an owning group that was largely whites, their resources being through either theft or through chicanery, not being fairly allocated. And a little bit later on, I get into the story of Fannie Lou Hamer, and her family was a victim of this, where they lost their land and were not ever fairly compensated. So it worked to the interest of the owning classes of the South and ultimately of this country to keep this population vulnerable and desperate. And they worked hand in hand in a policy sense to ensure that these two groups were excluded. The other example that I mentioned was housing policy. And one of the things about wealth in this country, it's largely held for most people in the hands of home ownership. If you're excluded from that, if your government has played a role in providing housing subsidies to one part of the population and keeping it from another part of the population, what has that done? It's meant that it has provided a wealth-generating set of policies for whites and kept that away from African Americans and other groups. Not only were decisions by the government raced, it meant that housing, from suburbanization through the kind of supports that, for example, FHA, which is a federal housing program, provided to banks to enable them to make loans with little risk. This meant that the racial segregation that was a part of the broader society was in fact being carried out by the federal government. The new housing that came out of the New Deal was Jim Crowed. New housing projects were kept lily white. African Americans did not have access to bank loans that were guaranteed by FHA. And so this meant a large category of wealth-generating possibility through home equity was kept out of the hands of African Americans. Is it any surprise, then, that by, you know, the 21st century, generationally, you don't have a circumstance where you have a home, you can tap into the equity, you might use that to help your son or daughter or your children to get a college education. By the time you retire, you paid your home off, you can tap into that. If all that's been excluded from you, is it any wonder that African Americans have 17 cents for every dollar that whites have?
And is there any wonder either, as you mentioned in your book, a reference to the social welfare policies and then the criminal justice system with the enlargement of prisons rather than the wealth of a group that could have its own way of supporting itself?
Absolutely.
Yeah. But what steps, if any, have changed the extent of the gap between blacks and white wealth? Which way has it gone, and what kinds of things took place? We have affirmative action, things of this sort, which have been criticized and strongly vilified at times. What other things have happened that have begun or tried to make a difference?
Right. And certainly we have to give all recognition to the civil rights movement struggle, because the decisions that supposedly happened, you know, 100 years prior to the civil rights movement in terms of the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments, which supposedly guaranteed political rights and equal protection under law, had to be fought for all over again. And it's very clear that the legislation coming out of that movement happened largely because of black resistance and black struggle. And when we talk about the 64 Civil Rights Act, the 65 Voting Rights Act, those were all important pieces of legislation, not ever done voluntarily, but because of the resistance and the persistence of African-American struggle, opened up some space, no doubt, for the creation of a somewhat larger black middle class. So that is a plus, but it also means that the class divide within the African-American community has gotten somewhat larger, that wealth is a little bit more concentrated in the black community because it has not been evenly distributed, that affirmative action has typically worked slightly better for those individuals who can get their foot in the door and have some degree of credentials. We know, as you mentioned, that all of this is under attack and that, in fact, there's been some diminution of the size of the black middle class. So it's not as if any of this stuff is ever guaranteed. You know, the political struggle continues. But those political decisions coming through the persistence of the African-American community did make a difference. Despite the criticism of affirmative action, it did open up spaces in some fields that were historically closed. And, of course, that fight continues for firefighters, for police officers, for access to working-class jobs, and the tensions around, you know, closing off those spaces. That's very real. And I do mention in my chapter the most recent fight in higher education, which has made it much more difficult for young black people to get access to higher education, even as the resources have worked for white students in terms of legacies, in terms of some of the programs that they also got points for, but that was never criticized. It was only, I would call them class points. It was only the racial, so-called racial points that penalized.
What is interesting, as you say that, is the quote that you make, I think, from Martin Luther King, is it a coincidence, quote, that the very same programs that helped expand the white middle class suddenly began to be called wasteful and non-essential when people of color began to benefit.
Absolutely.
And that's what was happening. The same kinds of programs are now considered to be derogatory and
right.
not possibly helpful.
But, you know, one of the things we want, and I certainly would want people to keep in mind, is that this is a space where the way this economy is organized, no doubt we live in a capitalist society, so that matters. There has also been long historical racism embedded in government policies, but policies can change. And so part of our message is that we have to fight for progressive policies because they can make a difference. They're not the complete solution, but because we're in a tremendous period of backlash, we shouldn't forget that people have fought for some of these policies. They have made somewhat of a difference. And we imagine 2050, if we can put these things on the agenda, that we might be in a different place, a different space. But as long as they're hidden away, as long as the rhetoric about a so-called colorblind society, which isn't colorblind, is out there, we need to reveal both the history and the current consequences of these policies.
Now, your view, give us the website for the group that you felt, you told me was organizing.
Indeed. For those who are interested in reading the book, buying the book, getting more information about it, we do have a website, which is www.colorofwealth, which is one word, and that's the title of the book, colorofwealth.org. And you can pull up the site and get ordering information as well as more information about the publication.
Do you see any commonalities and differences that cut across people of color? Because we're now talking about all the different minorities, so-called, but are really, when you put them all together, are the majority as far as people of color.
Right, and we make that point. And certainly by 2050, if we envision that period, will be the majority. And the interesting story is that many of the policies cut across these groups. They're distinctive stories. Certainly the land question with Native Americans mm-hmm. is distinctive from the forced labor enslavement question with African Americans. But what is quite true is that the government didn't have to reinvent the wheel. When they excluded in the Southwest Mexican children from schools and created schools that were segregated, all they did was draw upon the history of segregation that African Americans had experienced. So they didn't have to remake some of these policies, and they applied them across the board. So we saw those sets of commonalities, as well as, of course, some distinctive processes that make the solutions somewhat variable. But if we think in terms of coalition, if we think in terms of the integrated and interconnected policies that have been applied, then if we work together, I think it will make a difference rather than the divide and conquer that has been applied, dividing the white working class from people of color, dividing people of color from one another.
Dr. Rose Brewer, educator and author of Forged in Blood, Black Wealth and Justice in the United States, and the book The Color of Wealth, The Story Behind the United States Racial Wealth Divide. I thank you so much for being my guest on University Forum.
Thank you.
I'm Jean Moore. Please send your comments or questions on University Forum programs to me by email, jemoore@temple.org, or call my voicemail, 215-204-4376.